begun writing and speaking about a bondage closer to home, the position of American blacks enduring the long post-Civil War backlash of lynchings and Ku Klux Klan violence and the return of white supremacist rule throughout the South. As a veteran, he was especially angry that so few hopes of the war that ended slavery had been realized. The year he graduated from the seminary, Williams married and became pastor of the 12th Baptist Church, the major black congregation in Boston. In this job, as in others to come, he did not stay long. His life seems to have been infused with restlessness, for although he had considerable success in each new profession he took up, he seldom remained in it. After only a year as a minister, he moved to Washington, D.C., and founded a national black newspaper, The Commoner. The first issue proudly printed congratulatory letters from the famous abolitionists Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison. But the paper soon folded, and Williams returned to the ministry, this time in Cincinnati. He became a columnist for a local newspaper and once again started a paper of his own. Then, in another abrupt turn, he resigned his pulpit, studied law, and apprenticed himself to a lawyer. In 1879, at the age of 30, he was elected the first black member of the Ohio State Legislature, where he raised hackles by trying to win repeal of a law banning interracial marriages. He left the legislature after only one term. In his next career, Williams made a much greater mark, and by the time he again moved on, he left something substantial and lasting behind him. It was a massive book, History of the Negro Race in America from 1619 to 1880, Negroes as slaves, as soldiers, and as citizens, together with a preliminary consideration of the unity of the human family and historical sketch of Africa, and an account of the Negro governments of Sierra Leone and Liberia. Published in two volumes in 1882 and 1883, the book took its readers from early African kingdoms all the way through the Civil War and Reconstruction. Williams was a pioneer among American historians in the use of non-traditional sources. He sensed what most academics only began to acknowledge nearly 100 years later, that in writing the history of powerless people, drawing on conventional, published sources is far from enough. While traveling around the country, Williams did look through innumerable libraries, but he did much more. He wrote a letter to a national black newspaper asking readers to send him minutes of any colored church organization and other such documents. He wrote to General William Tecumseh Sherman asking his opinion of his black troops. He interviewed fellow Civil War veterans. And when his 1,092-page book appeared, it was widely and favorably reviewed. Several decades earlier, wrote the New York Times, patronizing but impressed, it would have been very generally doubted if one of that race could be the author of a work requiring so much native ability. W.E.B. Du Bois would later call Williams the greatest historian of the race. Williams began to travel the lecture circuit, addressing veterans groups, fraternal organizations, and church congregations, black and white. He seemed to have a speech for any occasion, from 4th of July celebrations to a meeting of the Philomathian Literary Society of Washington, and he soon signed up with the leading lecture agent of the day, James B. Pond, one of whose clients was Stanley. He managed to meet everyone from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow to Presidents Grover Cleveland and Rutherford B. Hayes, and many who met him came away with a positive impression of the earnest young man. Less impressed were many black Americans, who thought Williams too quick to turn his back on them in his eagerness to consort with the high and mighty. Despite his successes, money flowed through Williams's fingers, and he left a string of angry creditors behind him. He continued to pour his immense energy into a variety of projects. He wrote a second book about the experience of black soldiers in the Civil War. He went to New Mexico in search of land for a possible settlement of black farmers. He fired off articles for newspapers. He worked as a lawyer for the Cape Cod Canal Company. He wrote a play about the slave trade. He threw himself into the work of Union veterans organizations, receiving the honorary title of colonel from the most important of them, the Grand Army of the Republic. He testified before Congress in favor of a monument to black Civil War veterans. He was nominated as minister to Haiti by President Chester A. Arthur, for whom he had campaigned. But Arthur left office, and political enemies circulated rumors about Williams's debts, so the appointment did not take effect. Once, when Williams was meeting with Arthur at the White House, someone else had chosen the same time to see the president, Henry Shelton Sanford, then lobbying in Washington for United States recognition of Leopold's Congo. the president introduced his two visitors to each other. In the embryonic Congo state that Sanford described, William saw a chance to pursue the dream he had first mentioned in his seminary graduation speech. He wrote to one of Leopold's aides, proposing to recruit black Americans to work in the Congo. In Africa, surely, there would be the chance for pioneering and advancement then denied blacks in the United States. He also submitted a statement to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations urging recognition of the International Association of the Congo, and added the Congo to his list of lecture topics. In 1889, Williams won an assignment to write a series of articles from Europe for a press syndicate. He also tried, but failed, to be appointed an American delegate to the anti-slavery conference in Brussels. Nonetheless, he passed himself off as a delegate when he visited London. Brussels, he found, was a city filled with Europeans trying to outdo each other in condemning slavery, and in this atmosphere the young American son of a freed slave made a good impression. Yet despite his impressive list of achievements, Williams could not resist embellishing it. "Colonel Williams," reported the newspaper L'Independence Belge, who won his rank during the Civil War, "has written at least 5 or 6 works about Negroes. He was the first person to propose official recognition of the Congo state by the United States, and was allowed, to this end, to give a major speech to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations in Washington, which was crowned with complete success." The first newspaper piece William sent home from Belgium was an interview with Leopold, whom he described as a pleasant and entertaining conversationalist. His hair and full beard were carefully trimmed and liberally sprinkled with grey. His features were strong and clear-cut and keen, and his eyes, bright and quick, flashed with intelligent interest from behind a pair of eyeglasses. When Williams asked what the king expected in return for all the money he had spent developing the Congo, Leopold replied, "What I do there is done as a Christian duty to the poor African, and I do not wish to have one franc back of all the money I have expended." On this first meeting, Williams, like many others, was dazzled by the man whom he called one of the noblest sovereigns in the world, an emperor whose highest ambition is to serve the cause of Christian civilization, and to promote the best interests of his subjects, ruling in wisdom, mercy, and justice. Leopold clearly saw that the way to charm this particular visitor was to offer a sympathetic ear to his projects, for in the same article, Williams reported that the king proved himself a good listener. What he listened to, apparently, was Williams's long-cherished plan to put black Americans to work in Africa. Williams struck an agreement with a Belgian company to sign up 40 skilled artisans and take them to work in the Congo, and also made plans to write a book about the territory. When he returned to the United States, however, and gave his recruitment pitch at a black college in Virginia, he found a skeptical audience with many questions about life in Africa that he could not answer. At that point, he postponed the recruiting plan and decided to go first to the Congo and gather material for his book. That presented him with the job of raising the money for steamship tickets, food, supplies, and porters for the long trek around the rapids. The main patron he pursued was the American railroad baron Collis P. Huntington, who was a minor investor in the planned Congo Railway. Williams sought him out and followed the visit with a stream of flattering letters, which eventually produced a small subsidy for his African travels. In December 1889, Williams met President Benjamin Harrison at the White House. It is not clear that Harrison did more than wish him a good trip to Africa, but, as was often the case in his life, Williams later used this meeting with a man of power to imply that he was carrying out an important confidential mission for him. As Williams prepared for his trip, dropping references to his connection with the president and Huntington, Leopold and his aides grew suspicious that he might be covertly serving American businessmen intent on moving into the territory. When Williams passed through Brussels on the way to the Congo, he later said, "Every possible influence was exerted to turn me aside from my mission. An officer of the king's household was dispatched to me for the purpose of persuading me not to visit the Congo. He dwelt upon the deadly character of the climate during the rainy seasons, the perils and hardships of travelling by caravans, and the heavy expenses of the voyage. After this, the king sent for me and said that it was difficult to travel in the country, and more difficult to obtain wholesome food for white men, that he hoped I would postpone my visit to the Congo for at least 5 years, and that all necessary information would be furnished me in Brussels. In reply, I told His Majesty that I was going to the Congo now, and would start within a few days." Between January 1890 and the beginning of the following year, Williams sailed around the entire African continent, periodically sending Huntington urgent requests for more money. He managed to meet everyone from the vice president of the Boers Transvaal Republic to the Sultan of Zanzibar to the Khedive of Egypt, as well as to receive an honorary membership in Zanzibar's English club and to deliver a lecture at Cairo's Khedival Geographical Society. But his most important visit was to the Congo, where he spent 6 months proceeding on foot around the lower rapids and by steamer up the great river with many stops all the way to Stanley Falls. Travelling the river by steamboat at this time was a matter of progressing perhaps 30 miles a day, sometimes fewer when heading upstream. Each day the boat stopped in the late afternoon, sometimes docking at a state post or mission station, but more often being moored to the river bank for the night. The captain posted sentries and sent a crew of black woodcutters to chop down trees as fuel for the following day's run. One traveller described the typical scene. At dusk, huge fires were lit, and by the blaze of these, the men cut up the logs into small chunks, 3 or 4 feet in length. It was a sight attended with the thud, thud of the axes, the crash of the falling trees, then the firelight scene, with the scraping of the saw. The blocks were then tossed from hand to hand till they were all loaded onto the steamer. European or American passengers slept in cabins on board, usually on the upper deck. The woodcutters slept on shore on the ground. At dawn, a whistle blast brought the crew back on board or into canoes or a barge towed by the boat, and the paddle wheel at the stern slowly pushed the boat upstream. Making his way up the river in these slow stages, Williams had ample time to take in the Africa he had long dreamed of. A keen observer and experienced interviewer, he had the ability, as rare among journalists as it is among historians, to be uninfluenced by what others had already written. And in the villages and state posts and mission stations along the banks of the river, he found not the benignly ruled colony described by Stanley and others, but what he called the Siberia of the African continent. His impressions were distilled in the remarkable document he wrote at Stanley Falls when he could contain his rage no longer. At the beginning of his open letter to the king, Williams is respectful. "Good and great friend, I have the honour to submit for Your Majesty's consideration some reflections respecting the independent state of Congo based upon a careful study." By the second paragraph, though, he is referring Leopold to a higher authority, the King of Kings. And God, it is clear, is not pleased by what he sees happening in the Congo. The open letter is the work of a man who seems doubly horrified, first by what he has seen, and second by how thoroughly I have been disenchanted, disappointed, and disheartened, after all the praiseful things I have spoken and written of the Congo country, state, and sovereign. Almost immediately Williams gets down to business, assuming the tone of one of his many professions, that of a lawyer. "Every charge which I am about to bring against Your Majesty's personal government in the Congo has been carefully investigated. A list of competent and veracious witnesses, documents, letters, official records, and data has been faithfully prepared. The documents would be kept until such time as an international commission can be created with power to send for persons and papers, to administer oaths, and attest the truth or falsity of these charges." It is easy to imagine Leopold's fury on finding himself addressed in this prosecutorial voice by a foreigner, by someone he had tried to dissuade from going to the Congo in the first place, and, no less, by a black man. If it were printed as this book is, the open letter would run to only about 12 pages. Yet in that short space, Williams anticipated almost all the major charges that would be made by the International Congo Protest Movement of more than a decade later. Although by 1890 scattered criticism of Leopold's Congo state had been published in Europe, most of it focused on the king's discrimination against foreign traders. Williams's concern was human rights, and his was the first comprehensive, systematic indictment of Leopold's colonial regime written by anyone. Here are his main accusations. "Stanley and his white assistants had used a variety of tricks, such as fooling Africans into thinking that whites had supernatural powers, to get Congo chiefs to sign their land over to Leopold. For example, a number of electric batteries had been purchased in London, and when attached to the arm under the coat, communicated with a band of ribbon which passed over the palm of the white brother's hand, and when he gave the black brother a cordial grasp of the hand, the black brother was greatly surprised to find his white brother so strong that he nearly knocked him off his feet. When the native inquired about the disparity of strength between himself and his white brother, he was told that the white man could pull up trees and perform the most prodigious feats of strength. Another trick was to use a magnifying glass to light a cigar, after which the white man explained his intimate relation to the sun, and declared that if he were to request him to burn up his black brother's village, it would be done. In another ruse, a white man would ostentatiously load a gun, but covertly slip the bullet up his sleeve. He would then hand the gun to a black chief, step off a distance, and ask the chief to take aim and shoot. The white man, unharmed, would bend over and retrieve the bullet from his shoe. By such means and a few boxes of gin, whole villages have been signed away to Your Majesty. Land purchased in this way, Williams wrote, was territory to which Your Majesty has no more legal claim than I have to be the commander-in-chief of the Belgian army. Far from being a great hero, Stanley had been a tyrant. His name produces a shudder among this simple folk when mentioned. They remember his broken promises, his copious profanity, his hot temper, his heavy blows, his severe and rigorous measures by which they were mulcted of their lands. Note Williams's assumption, so unimaginable to his white contemporaries, that Africans had a right to African land. Of the hundreds of Europeans and Americans who travelled to the Congo in the state's early years, Williams is the only one on record as questioning Africans about their personal experience of Stanley. Leopold's establishment of military bases along the river had caused a wave of death and destruction, because the African soldiers who manned them were expected to feed themselves. These piratical buccaneering posts compelled the natives to furnish them with fish, goats, fowls, and vegetables at the mouths of their muskets, and whenever the natives refuse, white officers come with an expeditionary force and burn away the homes of the natives. Your Majesty's government is excessively cruel to its prisoners, condemning them for the slightest offences to the chain gang. Often these ox chains eat into the necks of the prisoners and produce sores about which the flies circle, aggravating the running wound. Leopold's claim that his new state was providing wise government and public services was a fraud. There were no schools and no hospitals except for a few sheds not fit to be occupied by a horse. Virtually none of the colony's officials knew any African language. The courts of Your Majesty's government are abortive, unjust, partial, and delinquent. Here, as elsewhere, Williams provided a vivid example. A white servant of the Governor-General went unpunished for stealing wine, while black servants were falsely accused and beaten. White traders and state officials were kidnapping African women and using them as concubines. White officers were shooting villagers, sometimes to capture their women, sometimes to intimidate the survivors into working as forced labourers, and sometimes for sport. Two Belgian army officers saw, from the deck of their steamer, a native in a canoe some distance away. The officers made a wager of £5 that they could hit the native with their rifles. Three shots were fired, and the native fell dead, pierced through the head. Instead of Leopold's being the noble anti-slavery crusader he portrayed himself as, Your Majesty's government is engaged in the slave trade, wholesale and retail. It buys and sells and steals slaves. Your Majesty's government gives £3 per head for able-bodied slaves for military service. The labour force at the stations of Your Majesty's government in the upper river is composed of slaves of all ages and both sexes. Williams was not done. 3 months after writing the open letter, he produced a report upon the Congo state and country to the President of the Republic of the United States of America. President Harrison probably had no more expected to hear from him than Leopold had. In writing to the President, Williams repeated his charges, adding that the United States had a special responsibility toward the Congo because it had introduced this African government into the sisterhood of states. As in the open letter, he supported the charges with personal examples. At Stanley Falls, slaves were offered to me in broad daylight, and at night I discovered canoe loads of slaves bound strongly together. Williams called for this oppressive and cruel government to be replaced by a new regime that would be local, not European, international, not national, just, not cruel. Whether Williams was calling for self-government or for international trusteeship, it would be many years before anyone else from Europe or the United States would do the same.
Whether Williams was calling for self-government or for international trusteeship, it would be many years before anyone else from Europe or the United States would do the same. In a letter Williams wrote to the American Secretary of State, he used a phrase that seems plucked from the Nuremberg trials of more than half a century later. Leopold's Congo State, Williams wrote, was guilty of crimes against humanity. The open letter was printed as a pamphlet, and before the end of 1890, while its author was still completing his circuit of Africa, it was distributed widely in both Europe and the United States. It is not clear who arranged for the distribution, but it was probably a Dutch trading company, the Neue Afrikaanse Handels Vennootschap, which had trading posts in the Congo and owned the steamboat the Holland, on which Williams travelled. Company officials were angry that Leopold was aggressively shutting out foreign traders from his new colony, saving the lucrative supplies of ivory for himself and his business partners. But Williams did not allow the company to shape his message. The open letter mentions the issue of free trade only briefly and far down on the list of accusations. After the open letter was published, the New York Herald, which had sent Stanley to Africa, devoted a full column to it under the headline, "The Administration of the African Free State Declared by an American Citizen to be Barbarous. Investigation Demanded." The article quoted Stanley, who called the open letter a deliberate attempt at blackmail. What was more ominous for Williams was that Collis P. Huntington, his benefactor, thought him grossly unfair to the king, who was solicitous of the best welfare of the natives of that country. A furious Leopold told the British minister in Brussels not to believe Williams. "Colonel Williams may be all the king says he is," the envoy reported to his home office, "but I suspect there is a good deal of disagreeable truth in his pamphlets." In his memoirs, one of Leopold's advisers recalls an urgent meeting held to discuss what to do about Le Pamphlet Williams, of which the Paris press was making un vrai scandale. Leopold and his aides quickly orchestrated a counterattack. The Journal de Bruxelles asked, "First of all, who is Mr. Williams? This man is not a United States colonel." In subsequent articles, the paper referred to him as the so-called colonel, the pseudo-colonel, an unbalanced Negro, and Mr. Williams, who is not a colonel. The Belgian press, of course, had never questioned the rank of General Henry Shelton Sanford. Le Mouvement Géographique, a newspaper closely tied to Leopold's Congo venture, also attacked Williams, and pointed out that, though Congo natives did not always receive full justice, neither did the American Indians. Other Belgian newspapers, however, took Williams's accusations seriously. With commercial speculation dominant in the Congo, a personal, absolute, and uncontrolled regime, whose chief autocrat has never set foot in the country he is governing, is fatally bound to produce the majority of grave deeds pointed out by the American traveller, wrote the liberal La Réforme. "We are not inclined to accept as gospel truth everything the Congolese administration wishes to offer in its own defence," declared Le Courrier de Bruxelles. Papers in other countries also picked up the story, reporting Williams's allegations and sometimes printing long excerpts. By June 1891, the furor reached the Belgian Parliament, where several deputies and the Prime Minister rose to speak in the King's defence. Some weeks later, the État indépendant du Congo issued a 45-page report signed by its top administrators. It was clearly aimed, the British legation in Brussels reported to London, at refuting the accusations brought by Colonel Williams and others. Williams, in the meantime, had completed his circuit of Africa and was in Egypt, where he had fallen seriously ill with tuberculosis. As usual, he was out of money. With his customary air of being on urgent business for the powerful, he somehow persuaded the British minister in Cairo, Sir Evelyn Baring, to dispatch a physician to take care of him. Down to his last £14, he sent desperate pleas for money to Huntington. When he recovered some strength, he wangled free passage to England on a British steamer. On board, he met a young Englishwoman who had been a governess in a British family in India, and by the time they arrived in Britain, the two were engaged. William settled in London, despite problems over his debts incurred there on a previous visit. But his tuberculosis grew worse. His fiancée and her mother took him to Blackpool, where they hoped the sea air would cure him so that he could resume working on his book about Leopold's Congo. Their hopes were in vain. Early on the morning of August 2nd, 1891, tended by his fiancée, her mother, a minister and a doctor, George Washington Williams died. He was 41 years old. In Belgium, Le Mouvement Géographique noted his death with satisfaction, comparing him with those who had burned the temple at Delphi. His early death, writes a modern diplomatic historian, S.J.S. Cookie, saved the Congo government from what might have been an embarrassingly formidable opponent. He was buried in Blackpool in an unmarked grave. Not until 1975 did his grave acquire a proper tombstone, arranged by his biographer, the historian John Hope Franklin. Only after the funeral, apparently, did Williams's British fiancée learn that he had abandoned a wife and a 15-year-old son in the United States. In this deception and other ways, from his neglect of debts to his vaunting a non-existent doctoral degree, there was something of the hustler about him. But, in a sense, this was the flip side of the extraordinary boldness that enabled him to defy a king, his officials, and the entire racial order of the day. By contrast, for example, there was George Grenfell, a veteran British missionary whom Williams visited on the Congo River. He, too, had seen firsthand the full range of abuses, including Leopold's state employees buying chained slaves. But, he wrote home within a few days of meeting Williams, he did not feel he could publicly question the action of the state. And whatever Williams's elaboration of his own resume, virtually everything he wrote about the Congo would later be corroborated, abundantly, by others. Williams's open letter was a cry of outrage that came from the heart. It gained him nothing. It lost him his patron, Huntington. It guaranteed that he could never work, as he had hoped, to bring American blacks to the Congo. It brought him none of the money he always needed, and in the few months he had left before his life ended in a foreign beach resort, it earned him little but calumny. By the time he went to the Congo in 1890, close to 1,000 Europeans and Americans had visited the territory or worked there. Williams was the only one to speak out fully and passionately and repeatedly about what others denied or ignored. The years to come would make his words ever more prophetic. Chapter 8. Where There Aren't No Ten Commandments. Leopold established the capital of his new Congo state at the port town of Boma, just upriver from the Atlantic, where Stanley had finished his epic trans-African trek in 1877. As the 1890s began, Boma was complete with a narrow-gauge trolley, a steam engine pulling a couple of cars, that linked the bustling docks and trading company warehouses to a cooler plateau above. There stood the government offices and houses for the Europeans who worked in them. Boma also boasted a Catholic church made of iron, a hospital for Europeans, a post office, a military base whose cannon fired a salute to any newly arriving VIP, and a two-story hotel. Three times a day, at 6 a.m., 11:45, and 6:30 p.m., about 75 white officials took the trolley down the hill and through a plantation of banana trees for meals in the hotel dining room. The only European who ate elsewhere was the Governor-General, who took his meals in his dignified Victorian mansion, complete with a cupola, French windows, and covered porches. Every year the King's birthday was celebrated with such events as a ceremonial review of troops, a target-shooting contest, and a concert by a Catholic black children's choir. Despite his impressive mansion, guarded by African sentries with blue uniforms and red fezes, the Congo's Governor-General had far less power than did a British, French, or German colonial governor. More than any other colony in Africa, the Congo was administered directly from Europe. The real headquarters of the État indépendant du Congo were not in Boma, but in suites of offices in Brussels, one on the grounds of the Royal Palace, the others next door or across the street. All the high- and middle-level administrators were picked and promoted by the king himself, and a mini-cabinet of three or four Belgians at the top, in Brussels, reported to Leopold directly. His one-man rule over this huge territory was in striking contrast to Leopold's ever more limited power at home. Once, in his later years, while he was talking in his study with several cabinet ministers, his nephew and heir apparent, Prince Albert, opened a window and a draft blew some papers onto the floor. Leopold ordered Albert to pick them up. Let him do it, the king said to one of the ministers who had hastily offered to do so instead. A future constitutional monarch must learn to stoop. But in the Congo there was no stooping. Leopold's power was absolute. At the lowest level, the king's rule over his colony was carried out by white men in charge of districts and river stations throughout the vast territory. Some of them were not visited by steamboats for months at a time. Far in the interior, practice often lagged behind theory. But on paper, at least, even the humblest station chief was allotted a bottle of red wine per day and a plentiful supply of English marmalade, Danish butter, canned meats, soups and condiments and foie gras and other pâtés from fishers of Strasbourg. For these functionaries, there was a plethora of medals whose grades reflected the burgeoning hierarchy of imperial rule. For holders of the Order of the African Star, for instance, there were six classes, ranging from Grand Croix and Commandeur down to mere médaillé. The Royal Order of the Lion, created by Leopold to recognize merit and acknowledge services rendered to us, also had six classes. For African chiefs who collaborated with the regime, there was a special medal, bronze, silver, or gold-plated, depending on the degree of service rendered. It bore Leopold's profile on one side and, on the other, the Congo State coat of arms and the words loyalty and devotion. The white officials in Leopold's Congo were usually single men, many of whom took on one or more African concubines. But by the turn of the century, a few officials began to bring their wives, and some of those who didn't turned to an enterprising British matchmaking agency that supplied mail-order brides from Europe. Photographs of remote Congo posts from the 1890s generally show the same pattern. From the long shadows, it appears to be late afternoon. The two or three white men in the picture wear suits and ties and elongated sun helmets, like a London bobby's cap in white. They are seated on wicker chairs, a dog at their feet, in front of a tent or simple thatched-roofed building, smiling. Behind them stand their unsmiling African servants, holding some emblem of their status. A serving tray, a towel draped over an arm, a bottle ready to pour. Wine glasses or teacups rest on a table, symbols of the comforts of home. The white men are always dressed in white. Underpinning such scenes were a number of royal decrees from Brussels. The first and most important had been issued on the very day in 1885 that the existence of the Congo State was formally proclaimed. It declared that all vacant land was the property of the state. There was no definition of what made land vacant. All over the world, of course, land that looks vacant has often been deliberately left to lie fallow while crops are planted somewhere else, especially in the tropics, where heavy rainfalls leach nutrients out of the soil. Leopold was after whatever could be quickly harvested. In that sense, he treated both vacant and non-vacant land as his property, claiming a right to all its products. He made no distinction between the tusks of an elephant roaming wild or villagers' vegetables that could feed his soldiers. It was all his. He did not, however, have the resources to exploit the entire territory, so another set of decrees carved parts of the Congo into several giant blocks, whose vacant land was leased out for long periods as concessions to private companies. These concession companies had shareholders, largely, though not entirely, Belgian, and interlocking directorates that included many high Congo state officials. But in each of them, the state, which in effect meant Leopold himself, usually kept 50% of the shares. In setting up this structure, Leopold was like the manager of a venture capital syndicate today. He had essentially found a way to attract other people's capital to his investment schemes while he retained half the proceeds. In the end, what with various taxes and fees the companies paid the state, it came to more than half. Unlike a venture capitalist in the marketplace, however, the king deployed troops and government officials as well as investment funds. He used them ruthlessly to shut out of the territory most businesses in which he did not have a piece of the action. The Dutch trading firm on whose steamboat Williams had travelled found itself facing stiff competition for ivory from Congo state officials who stopped its boats, in one case with gunfire. Once, according to a history of the company, a state of siege was proclaimed for a certain region which made it closed territory for traders. When the state of siege was lifted, all the ivory had disappeared. The king, meanwhile, continued to claim that making a profit was the farthest thing from his mind. I thank you for having done justice yesterday to the calumnies spread by enemies of the Congo State, to the accusation of secrecy and the spirit of gain, he wrote to the Prime Minister after a parliamentary debate in 1891. The Congo state is certainly not a business. If it gathers ivory on certain of its lands, that is only to lessen its deficit. And if Africans were made to help out in the ivory gathering, why that too, heaven forbid, was not to make a profit, but to rescue these benighted people from their indolence. Talk of the lazy native accompanied the entire European land grab in Africa, just as it had been used to justify the conquest of the Americas. To an American reporter, Leopold once declared, "In dealing with a race composed of cannibals for thousands of years, it is necessary to use methods that will best shake their idleness and make them realize the sanctity of work." As the 1890s began, the work whose sanctity Leopold prized most highly was seizing all the ivory that could be found. Congo state officials and their African auxiliaries swept through the country on ivory raids, shooting elephants, buying tusks from villagers for a pittance, or simply confiscating them. Congo peoples had been hunting elephants for centuries, but now they were forbidden to sell or deliver ivory to anyone other than an agent of Leopold. A draconian refinement of the ivory-gathering method, which set the pattern for much that was to come, was a commission structure the king imposed in 1890, whereby his agents in the field got a cut of the ivory's market value, but on a sliding scale. An agent received only 6% of the value of any ivory purchased at 8 francs per kilo, but the commission climbed, in stages, to 10% for ivory bought at 4 francs per kilo. The European agents thus had a powerful incentive to force Africans, if necessary at gunpoint, to accept extremely low prices. Almost none of these Belgian francs actually reached any Congolese elephant hunters. They received only small amounts of cloth, beads and the like, or the brass rods that the state decreed as the territory's main currency. For Africans, transactions in money were not allowed. Money in free circulation might undermine what was essentially a command economy. The commands were above all for labour. At the beginning, the state most wanted porters. Like Stanley, any official who ventured away from the river system and into the bush to collect ivory, set up new posts, put down a rebellion, needed long columns of porters to carry everything from machine gun ammunition to all that red wine and pâté. These tens of thousands of porters were usually paid for their work, if only sometimes the food necessary to keep them going. But most of them were conscripts. Even children were put to work. One observer noted 7 to 9-year-olds, each carrying a load of 22 pounds. A file of poor devils, chained by the neck, carried my trunks and boxes toward the dock, a Congo state official notes matter-of-factly in his memoirs. At the next stop on his journey, more porters were needed for an overland trip. There were about 100 of them, trembling and fearful before the overseer, who strolled by, whirling a whip. For each stocky and broad-backed fellow, how many were skeletons, dried up like mummies, their skin worn out, seamed with deep scars, covered with suppurating wounds. No matter, they were all up to the job. Porters were needed most at the points where the river system was blocked by rapids, particularly, until the railroad was built, for the 3-week trek between the port town of Matadi and Stanley Pool. This was the pipeline up which supplies passed to the interior and down which ivory and other riches were carried to the sea. Moving dismantled steamboats to the upper section of the river was the most labor-intensive job of all. One steamboat could comprise 3,000 porter loads. Here is how Edmund Picard, a Belgian senator, described a caravan of porters he saw on the route around the Big Rapids in 1896. "Unceasingly we meet these porters. Black, miserable, with only a horribly filthy loincloth for clothing, frizzy and bare head supporting the load, box, bale, ivory tusk, barrel, most of them sickly, drooping under a burden increased by tiredness and insufficient food, a handful of rice and some stinking dried fish. Pitiful, walking caryatids, beasts of burden with thin monkey legs, with drawn features, eyes fixed and round from preoccupation with keeping their balance and from the days of exhaustion. They come and go like this by the thousands, requisitioned by the state armed with its powerful militia, handed over by chiefs whose slaves they are and who make off with their salaries. Trotting with bent knees, belly forward, an arm raised to steady the load, the other leaning on a long walking stick, dusty and sweaty. Insects spreading out across the mountains and valleys their many files and their task of Sisyphus, dying along the road or, the journey over, heading off to die from overwork in their villages. The death toll was particularly high among porters forced to carry loads long distances. Of the 300 porters conscripted in 1891 by District Commissioner Paul Lemarinel for a forced march of more than 600 miles to set up a new post, not one returned. Stanislas Lefranc, a devout Catholic and monarchist, was a Belgian prosecutor who had come to the Congo to work as a magistrate. Early one Sunday morning in Leopoldville, he heard the sound of many children screaming desperately. On tracing the howls to their source, Lefranc found some 30 urchins, of whom several were 7 or 8 years old, lined up and waiting their turn, watching, terrified, their companions being flogged. Most of the urchins, in a paroxysm of grief, kicked so frightfully that the soldiers ordered to hold them by the hands and feet had to lift them off the ground. 25 times the whip lashed down on each of the children. The evening before, Lefranc learned, several children had laughed in the presence of a white man, who then ordered that all the servant boys in town be given 50 lashes. The second installment of 25 lashes was due at 6 o'clock the next morning. Lefranc managed to get these stopped, but was told not to make any more protests that interfered with discipline. Lefranc was seeing in use a central tool of Leopold's Congo, which in the minds of the territory's people soon became as closely identified with white rule as the steamboat or the rifle. It was the chicotte, a whip of raw, sun-dried hippopotamus hide cut into a long, sharp-edged corkscrew strip. Usually the chicotte was applied to the victim's bare buttocks. Its blows would leave permanent scars. More than 25 strokes could mean unconsciousness, and 100 or more, not an uncommon punishment, were often fatal. Lefranc was to see many more chicotte beatings, although his descriptions of them in pamphlets and newspaper articles he published in Belgium provoked little reaction. The station chief selects the victims. Trembling, haggard, they lie face down on the ground. Two of their companions, sometimes four, seize them by the feet and hands and remove their cotton drawers. Each time that the torturer lifts up the chicotte, a reddish stripe appears on the skin of the pitiful victims, who, however firmly held, gasp in frightful contortions. At the first blows, the unhappy victims let out horrible cries, which soon become faint groans. In a refinement of evil, some officers, and I've witnessed this, demand that when the sufferer gets up, panting, he must graciously give the military salute. The open horror Lefranc expressed succeeded only in earning him a reputation as an oddball or troublemaker. He shows an astonishing ignorance of things which he ought to know because of his work. A mediocre agent, the acting governor-general wrote in a personnel evaluation. In an attempt to quiet his complaints, Lefranc wrote, officials ordered that executions at his post be carried out in a new location instead of next to his house. Except for Lefranc, few Europeans working for the regime left records of their shock at the sight of officially sanctioned terror. The white men who passed through the territory as military officers, steamboat captains, or state or concession company officials generally accepted the use of the chicotte as unthinkingly as hundreds of thousands of other men in uniform would accept their assignments a half-century later to staff the Nazi and Soviet concentration camps. Monsters exist, wrote Primo Levi of his experience at Auschwitz, but they are too few in number to be truly dangerous. More dangerous are the functionaries ready to believe and to act without asking questions. What made it possible for the functionaries in the Congo to so blithely watch the chicotte in action, and, as we shall see, to deal out pain and death in other ways as well? To begin with, of course, was race. To Europeans, Africans were inferior beings, lazy, uncivilized, little better than animals. In fact, the most common way they were put to work was, like animals, as beasts of burden. In any system of terror, the functionaries must first of all see the victims as less than human, and Victorian ideas about race provided such a foundation. Then, of course, the terror in the Congo was sanctioned by the authorities. For a white man to rebel meant challenging the system that provided your livelihood. Everyone around you was participating. By going along with the system, you were paid, promoted, awarded medals. So men who would have been appalled to see someone using a chicotte on the streets of Brussels or Paris or Stockholm accepted the act, in this different setting, as normal. We can hear the echo of this thinking in another context, half a century later. To tell the truth, said Franz Stangl of the mass killings that took place when he was commandant of the Nazi death camps of Sobibor and Treblinka, one did become used to it. In such a regime, one thing that often helps functionaries become used to it is a slight symbolic distance, irrelevant to the victim, between an official in charge and the physical act of terror itself. That symbolic distance was frequently cited in self-defense by Nazis put on trial after World War II. Dr. Johann Paul Kramer, for example, an SS physician who liked to do his pathology research on human tissue that was still fresh, explained, "The patient was put on the dissecting table while he was still alive. I then approached the table and put several questions to the man as to such details which pertained to my researches. When I had collected my information, the orderly approached the patient and killed him with an injection in the vicinity of the heart. I myself never made any lethal injections. Although some whites in the Congo enjoyed wielding the shikot, most put a similar symbolic distance between themselves and the dreaded instrument. At first, I took upon myself the responsibility of meting out punishment to those whose conduct during the previous day seemed to warrant such treatment, recalled Raoul de Prémorel, who worked for a company operating in the Kasai River Basin. Soon, I found it desirable to assign the execution of sentences to others under my direction. The best plan seemed to be to have each capita, African foreman, administer the punishment for his own gang. And so the bulk of shikot blows were inflicted by Africans on the bodies of other Africans. This, for the conquerors, served a further purpose. It created a class of foremen from among the conquered, like the capos in the Nazi concentration camp and the predurki, or trustees, in the Soviet gulag. Just as terrorizing people is part of conquest, so is forcing someone else to administer the terror. If the underling's allegiance is unreliable, sometimes the conquerors take precautions. When 18 mutinous black soldiers were executed in Boma in 1900, a photographer recorded the scene. The condemned rebels are tied to stakes, and a firing squad of loyal black troops has just fired a salvo. But in case the loyalists waver, the entire white male population of Boma is standing in a long row at right angles to both groups, each sun-helmeted white man with a rifle at the ready. Finally, when terror is the unquestioned order of the day, wielding it efficiently is regarded as a manly virtue, the way soldiers value calmness in battle. This is the ultimate in becoming used to it. Here, for instance, a station chief named Georges Bricus describes in his diary a hanging he ordered in 1895 of a man who had stolen a rifle. The gallows is set up. The rope is attached, too high. They lift up the nigger and put the noose around him. The rope twists for a few moments, then crack. The man is wriggling on the ground. A shot in the back of the neck and the game is up. It didn't make the least impression on me this time. And to think that the first time I saw the shikot administered, I was pale with fright. Africa has some use, after all. I could now walk into fire as if to a wedding. The framework of control that Leopold extended across his enormous realm was military. After all, without armed force, you cannot make men leave their homes and families and carry 65-pound loads for weeks or months. The king was particularly happy to run his own army in Africa, since in Belgium he was forever at loggerheads with legislators who did not share his passion for building great forts, spending more money on the army, and instituting the draft. Leopold had made use of African mercenaries ever since sending Stanley to stake out his claim from 1879 to 1884. In 1888 he formally organized them into the Force Publique, an army for his new state. Over the next dozen years, it grew to more than 19,000 officers and men, the most powerful army in Central Africa. By the late 1890s, it consumed more than half the state's budget. At once counter-guerrilla troops, an army of occupation, and a corporate labor police force, it was divided mainly into small garrisons, typically several dozen black soldiers under one or two white officers on a river bank. The initial handful of military posts quickly grew to 183 by 1900 and to 313 by 1908. The Force Publique had its hands full. Many of the king's new subjects belonged to warrior peoples who fought back. More than a dozen different ethnic groups staged major rebellions against Leopold's rule. The Yaka people fought the whites for more than 10 years before they were subdued in 1906. The Chokwe fought for 20 years, inflicting heavy casualties on Leopold's soldiers.
The Boer and the Buja mobilized more than 5,000 men to fight a guerrilla war from deep within the rainforest. Just as Americans used the word pacification in Vietnam 70 years later, so the Force Publique's military expeditions were officially called Reconnaissance Pacifique. The history of Central Africa before the European arrival was as filled with wars and conquests as Europe's own, and even during Leopold's rule, not all the Congo's violence was between colonizer and colonized. Because so many Congo peoples had earlier fought among themselves, the Force Publique was often able to ally itself with one ethnic group to defeat another. But sooner or later, the first group found itself subdued as well. With their forces stretched thin over a huge territory, Leopold's commanders made clever use of this shifting pattern of alliances. In the end, though, their superior firepower guaranteed victory, and a history written by the victors. Yet sometimes, even through those records, we can glimpse the determination of those who resisted the king. In Katanga, in the far south, warriors from the Sanga people were led by a chief named Mulame Nyama. Though the state troops were armed with artillery, his forces put up a stiff fight, killing one officer and wounding three soldiers. They then took refuge in a large chalk cave called Chamakela. The Force Publique commander ordered his men to light fires at the three entrances to the cave to smoke the rebels out, and after a week he sent an emissary to negotiate Mulame Nyama's surrender. The chief and his men refused. Soldiers lit the fires again and blocked the cave for 3 months. When the troops finally entered it, they found 178 bodies. Fearful of leaving any sign of a martyr's grave, the Force Publique soldiers triggered landslides to obliterate all traces of the existence of the Chamakele cave and of the bodies of Mulame Nyama and his men. Another rebellion took place along the caravan route around the lower Congo rapids. A notorious state agent, a Belgian named Eugène Rommel, built a station there to procure porters for the 3-week trek from Matadi to Stanley Pool, a job for which the state needed 50,000 men a year by the mid-1890s. Unlike the Protestant missionaries and some private traders who hired the porters they used on this route and negotiated wages with them, the Congo state, at Leopold's specific order, used forced labor. Rommel named his station Baka Baka, which means capture, capture. A local chief named Nzansu led an uprising, ambushing and killing Rommel on December 5, 1893, and burning his station to the ground. The rebels also burned and pillaged two other nearby state posts, where they killed two white officials and wounded several more. However, Nzansu spared Mukimbungu, a Swedish mission on the caravan route. He even gave the missionaries some supplies he had found abandoned on the trail and returned some goods his men had taken from the mission station. One of the missionaries, Carl Theodor Andersson, wrote to his church members back in Sweden, "If our friends of the mission at home are worried for our safety here as a result of letters and newspaper reports about the unrest in these parts, I wish to reassure them. The leader of the rebels, Chief Nzansu of Kasi, has let us know that he does not wish harm to any one of us, as we have always shown that we are friends of the black people. But to the men of the state he has sworn death, and anyone who knows of the conditions out here cannot feel surprised." This rebellion particularly alarmed the state because it completely stopped traffic on the crucial caravan route to Stanley Pool. To crush the rebels, the authorities sent out a force of 15 white officers and 200 black soldiers. Another Swedish missionary, C. N. Börjesson, wrote home a few weeks later, "The rebels have not fled, but have assembled in the leader's village, which they are defending unto death, although their other villages have been burned." Börjesson goes on to speak powerfully for the rebels, whose own voices we cannot hear. "A man sows what he reaps. In reality, the state is the true source of these uprisings. It is strange that people who claim to be civilized think they can treat their fellow man, even though he is of a different color, any which way. Without a doubt, one of the most disreputable of the officials is the late Mr. Rommel. One should not speak ill of the dead, but I must simply mention some smaller matters to prove that the unrest has been justified. He imprisoned women when the people refused to transport supplies and to sell him goods below market prices. He was not ashamed to come by our station and abduct our schoolgirls, and treat them in despicable ways.
One Sunday morning, Brother Anderson and I went to a neighbouring village and helped release three poor women whom his soldiers had imprisoned because one of them had asked for the return of a stone jug which had been taken from her. But what happens to all of the women who are taken prisoner? Some are set free when their husbands have done all they can to regain the one who is dearest to them. Others are forced to work in the fields and also to work as prostitutes. Our most respected men here have told us with tears in their eyes and much vexation in their hearts that they had recently seen a group of 700 women chained together and transported to the coast on steamboats. And, they said, whether they cut off our heads or that of a chicken, it is all the same to them. So can anyone feel truly surprised that the discontent has finally come to the surface? Nzansu, the leader of the uprising, and Rommel's assassin, only wanted to become the Engelbrecht of the Congo and the Gustav Vasa of his people. His followers are as loyal to him as Swedes were to their leaders in those times. The missionary's comparison was to two Swedish patriots of the 15th and 16th centuries, noblemen who led rebellions of Swedish peasants against harsh foreign kings. Vasa was successful and was himself elected king of Sweden. Nzansu was less fortunate. He and his warriors fought on against Leopold's Force Publique for 8 months, and, despite several scorched earth expeditions sent against them, continued to fight sporadically for 5 more years. There seems to be no record of Nzanzu's fate. All the commissioned officers and some sergeants of the Force Publique were white, mostly Belgian, but from other countries as well. Their own armies were usually happy to give them leave to gain a few years' combat experience. All the ordinary soldiers were black. Mercenaries from Zanzibar and the British West African colonies in the army's first few years were soon outnumbered by soldiers from the Congo itself, most of whom were conscripts. Even those who volunteered often did so because, as one soldier explained to a European visitor, he preferred to be with the hunters rather than with the hunted. Ill-paid, ill-fed, and flogged with a chicot for the slightest offence, many tried to desert, and in the early days officers had to spend much of their time capturing them. Then, to guard against desertions, the state began sending new conscripts far from their home districts. As a soldier finishing your 7-year term, you might then face a journey of several hundred to 1,000 miles to get home. Sometimes even then you would not be allowed to go. The soldiers' frustrations frequently boiled over into mutinies, large and small. The first big one erupted at the military base at Luluaburg in the south-central Savannah country in 1895. The base commander, Mathieu Pelzer, was a notorious bully who used his fists on those under him and routinely ordered soldiers given 125 lashes with the chicot. When his African concubine slept with another man, he ordered her killed. At one point, Pelzer ordered a soldier punished, but before the man wielding the chicot could begin, a sergeant named Candolo went up to him and snatched the whip out of his hands. When rebellion against Pelzer broke out shortly afterward, it was led by angry black non-commissioned officers, with Candolo at their head. Soldiers attacked and wounded Pelzer, who fled into the bush and hid, but the rebels tracked him down and killed him. Under Candolo, dressed in white and riding on a bull, they set off for other Force Publique posts, gathering supporters among the black soldiers and killing several European officers. For more than half a year, the rebels controlled most of the Kasai region. In the bush, they split into small groups, spreading out over a broad area and successfully evading or fighting off a long series of heavily armed expeditions sent against them. A year later, worried Force Publique officers estimated that there were still 400 to 500 rebels at large, recruiting new members and allying themselves with local chiefs against the state. Altogether, suppressing the revolt cost the Force Publique the lives of several hundred black soldiers and porters and 15 white officers or NCOs. One was an American, Lieutenant Lindsay Burke, a 26-year-old native of New Orleans, who had been in Africa less than a year. He marched into an ambush and died, along with 27 of his men, in early 1897. The rebel leader Candolo was fatally wounded in battle, but two corporals who played a major role in the revolt, Yamba Yamba and Kimpuki, fought on as guerrilla leaders. They were killed, still fighting, in 1908, 13 years after the uprising began. At the other end of the country, in the far northeast, a great mutiny broke out in 1897 among 3,000 soldiers and an equal number of porters and auxiliaries. the men who had been forced to march for months through forests and swamps in a renewed reach by Leopold toward the headwaters of the Nile, finally had enough. The fighting went on for 3 years as column after column of loyalist Fausse Publique troops fought the rebels over some 600 miles of forest and savanna along the chain of lakes on the Congo's eastern border. Beneath their own red and white flag, rebels from different ethnic groups fought together, maintained military discipline, and staged ambushes to replenish their supplies of weapons and ammunition. Sympathetic chiefs gave them support, including warnings by talking drum of approaching troops. Even the Fausse Publique's official history acknowledges that in battle, the rebels displayed a courage worthy of a better cause. More than 2 years after the revolt began, the rebels were able to muster 25,000